As the new rabbi of Shaarei Shamayim, it's a pleasure to welcome Torah in Motion to Shaarei Shamayim. But it's a little odd for me to be the one offering the welcomes. To a really great extent, I'm being welcomed here by everyone who's joining together to learn Torah on the afternoon of Tisha B'Av to dwell on some of the themes of the day. I want to acknowledge the people who preceded me in speaking here tonight, today. Dr. Lakshin and Rabbi Skobach, and of course also to give gratitude to Rabbi Kelman for arranging this wonderful opportunity to come together and to learn Torah. In Oxford, there is a botanical garden that sits right pretty much in the center of current modern-day Oxford, right along the Cherwell River. And if you go to the gate of this botanical garden, you will see a plaque right outside that that garden. The plaque reads, "Here is where the ancient Jewish cemetery existed, that was basically disbanded in the 12th century when the Jews were expelled from England." And throughout Europe, you will find many examples and really a great difference between how the Jews and the Gentiles would bury their dead. That the Gentiles would always bury their dead right in the center of their churches, right in the center of their towns. And you can still see this in Oxford till this day. And the Jews would bury really on the outskirts. And that botanical garden was really in the outskirts of the ancient city of Oxford. There is a midrash, I believe it was quoted by the Yalkut Shimoni, that talks about a king and a son. And the king and the son are traveling together. And as I'm sure anyone here with young children can testify, the children often get a little bit antsy at the end of such trips. I know driving up from New Jersey to Toronto a couple of weeks ago, my 3-year-old piped up as we were crossing the Peace Bridge and said, "You know, this is a long trip. When are we going to get there?" And so, sure enough, according to this mashal, the son says to his father, "When are we going to get there?" And the response, which of course brings out that quality of how we build our cemeteries as Jews, is that when you reach that point, where you reach that time where you see the burial of the dead, when you see the cemeteries, that's how you know that you're about to reach the city. That's how you know that you've left the wilderness. And in terms of our understanding of our experience of suffering as a people, to be able to, on the afternoon of Tisha B'Av, after the time of crime, once again sitting in our chairs, to see in the opportunity of mourning, to see the opportunity of the tears, of the loss, to know that we're getting closer to that time when our journey will have ended and we will have successfully reached our destination, that itself is a cause for a small amount of inspiration. I want to address a topic which takes off somewhat on what Dr. Lakshin spoke about, but takes it in a slightly, might say, more traditional direction, but we'll judge it as it comes out. Dr. Lakshin addressed the question of how is it that we respond to suffering? When we see that cemetery, when we see the time, the troubles of our people, how is it that we respond? And Dr. Lakshin argued quite successfully that in light of much of Chazal's statement about the experience in Mitzrayim, the experience in Egypt, we can see within destruction opportunity, that there's something to be learned from the experience of exile. I want to look at some sources which would seem to argue not to the opposite direction, but taking a slightly different tack. So let's look at our first source here. I'm sure it'll be familiar to many of us. It's perhaps one of the most classic sources that anyone who has heard a shiur on Tisha B'Av will immediately recognize. Aval Mikdash Sheni, the second temple. Shehayu Oskim B'Torah U'V'Mitzvah Sugmilot Chasadim B'tnei Macharav. And during this time period, when the Jewish people were engaged in the study of Torah, when they performed mitzvot, and they acted kindly to one another, and they performed this gemilat chesed, mipnei macharav. Why was it destroyed? Why would such a temple be destroyed? So answered the Talmud, mipnei shehayta bo sinat chinam. Because within that society which engaged with Torah, which performed mitzvot, which was gomel chesed, there was sinat chinam, called baseless hatred, gratuitous hatred, senseless hatred. There was sinat chinam. L'lamedcha, this teaches us, sheshkula sinat chinam kineged shalosh averos, that sinat chinam is equivalent or can be weighed against the three cardinal sins, the three big sins, the ones that we, each of us know, are the three sins that a person must choose death rather than to commit: avodah zara, giloy arayot, ushfichot damim, idolatry, adultery, and murder. The earlier part of this piece of the Talmud that I don't have in front of us in the source sheets referenced the first temple, where we are told that during that time period there was idolatry, adultery, and murder, and that was the cause for that temple's destruction. As this piece of Talmud continues, I'm not sure if this is a question that bothers you. This is a question that always bothered me when I learned this piece of Talmud, which is, in order to commit a murder, don't you have to hate the guy? Was there no sinat chinam during the first temple as well? The Talmud here in Yuma, in fact, asked that question. And in giving an answer, tells us something which I believe is very, very important to understand the nature of the argument of what caused this destruction. The Gemara answers that during the time of the first temple, it was the Nisi'im, it was the leaders who committed the murders, who had that hate. And that was the cause of that destruction. Whereas in the second temple period, it was something far more universal. The sinat chinam was something that animated everyone in a way that was pervasive in the society as a whole. And that the Gemara here describes sinat chinam is talking about something which is everywhere. When we read Eicha, when we say the keynote, we are struck and we're stunned by the degree of destruction that has accompanied us throughout our history. We shed tears over it. It's something which is traumatic, extremely difficult to understand. And many keynotes operate on the principle that it's not for us to begin to answer that question. Certainly the early keynote in Eicha itself operate on the principle primarily that Eicha, how could this be? Why? And we don't attempt to really give answers. But you look at a piece of Gemara like this one, and suddenly we're asking straight out, point blank, Bipnecha Macharav, why is it that this happens? Why is it that we have to have a Tisha B'Av? Why is it that we mourn year after year in this way? The answer that is given is an answer which takes responsibility for our fate. One of the primary elements of Jewish theology is that we control our destiny by our actions. We don't believe in predetermination, despite the fact that we believe in an omnipotent God. And with some degree of remove, our chazal, our teachers, tell us We're responsible for the destruction of the temple. It was because of us that this happened. How are we to understand that? How are we to live with such an accusation? Eov, Job, was unwilling to allow his friends to suggest that somehow he was responsible for his fate. To such a degree, to such an extent, to several catastrophes, we are the ones who are responsible. So what I'd like to suggest here is that when you have the word Eicha, when you have the words Mipnei Ma, you can understand this concept in two ways. One is why. The word Eicha is for what reason. The other way to understand it is how. How did this come about? What was the process through which it happened? And I don't believe that the Gemara that we have in front of us is exclusively looking for the mechanics. I believe that there is a moral position here as well. But what I will argue from in the next couple of sources is that there's much more to the statement that the Second Temple was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam than just a traditional look at the mechanics of divine punishments. That quite literally, the temple was destroyed because of the Sinat Chinam. In a how sense, not necessarily in a why sense. So let's look at the next source. This next source is taken from the Gemara in Gittin, Daf Nun Vav, Amud Aleph. This Gemara really introduces the whole story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, which is the prototype, the great story of Sinat Chinam, the story of two men, one by the name of Kamsa, one by the name of Bar Kamsa. The wrong guy is invited to a party, and the Baal HaBas throws out Bar Kamsa, and as a result of that fight, he goes to the Romans, instigates the Romans come, and sure enough, the temple is destroyed because someone was not invited to a party. This is the introduction to that whole piece of Talmud, something which is traditionally studied on Tisha B'Av. Havu Bahar Ba Hanhu Tlasa Asiri. There were in Jerusalem three rich men. Nachtimon ben Gurion, ben Kalba Savua, uben Tisus HaKesas. These three men. And each of them had a very odd name. And the Talmud itself is bothered by name. What kind of person's name is ben Kalba Savua? What kind of name is ben Tisus HaKesas? So we are told, Nachtimon ben Gurion, Shenachta Lochama Ba'avuro, because the sun reappeared on a very cloudy day, like one day, like today, specifically for his merit, the sun broke through those clouds. The Gemara in Tanis tells us a story that there was a time of famine, a time of drought in the land of Israel, and there was not going to be enough water for the Ole L'Regel, those people who were traveling to Jerusalem, to be able to drink on the Yamim Tovim. So Nachtima ben Gurion took out a loan in which he borrowed a vast amount of water supplies to give water to the people of who are Ola L'Regel, people who are going up to Yerushalayim. And at a certain point, the debt was going to come due. And Nachtima ben Gurion was stuck. So his creditor came to him and said to him, you know, pay up. You said that you would return the water. I don't have the water yet. The drought is continuing. Pay me back in silver. Pay me that weight that you had promised me, that you would give me the silver to equate with that water. And Nachtima ben Gurion waited and waited and waited until eventually his creditor went to the bathhouse to celebrate, and Nachtima ben Gurion went to the Beis HaMikdash to daven. And he said, Kadosh Baruch Hu, I didn't do this for my honor. I did this for you. Help me out. And suddenly there was tremendous rains. And the skies got darkened. And Nachtima ben Gurion went out to meet his creditor and said, look, you know, here's the water. The cisterns have been refilled. I can now repay you the water. And my debt has now been fulfilled. His creditor said, I don't know. It's already, the debt has passed. Look how dark it is. It's already night. Time's up. So Nachum Ben Gurion was the recipient of a tremendous miracle that the sun poked out through those clouds and was able to prove to his creditor that in fact the day was still there and that he had met the timeline for his death. So this is a very special person over here, Nachum Ben Gurion. So special that you can imagine even a prime minister would want to borrow a name from him. Ben Kaba Savua, Sheko Hanichnas Lebeso Kishura Eiv Kekelev, Yosekihu Shehu Saveya. Ben Kaba Savua, who according to some traditions was the father-in-law of Rabbi Akiva, he was called that name because any person who entered his house, hungry as a dog, would leave filled. He was a person who was a Baal Tzedakah. He would give to the hungry. Every person who came to his house would leave sated. Ben Tzitzis HaKeses, Shaita Tzitzato Nigreret Al Gabi Kastot. That his tzitzit, his garments, would always, his talis that he would wear, would have tzitzit hanging down from it, would always run against cushions. He'd only work on finely carpeted floors that were cushions. Ika da'ami, there are others who say, Shaita Kisto, that his seat, Muteles Bein Dole Rome, was placed among the great men of Rome, a very prominent individual. So these were the three wealthy men, the three gvirim of Yerushalayim at that time. The time of the Second Temple's destruction, the time of the siege, when Vespasian came to Jerusalem to lay siege to the city in the year 67 through 70, the time of the Roman conquest. Charam Arluhu, one said, Ana Zaina Lahu Bechiti Vesa'are, I will provide wheat and barley to provide for the entire people of Yerushalayim. V'chad amar lehu, and one said, B'dechamra, B'demalcha, B'mashcha. Other one said, I will provide wine, I will provide salt, I will provide oil for the entire city. V'chad amar lehu, B'detzivi. And one said, I will provide fuel, I'll provide wood for the city as well. Now, I know that gas prices are pretty high these days, and apparently they were pretty high back then also, because v'shavku rabbanan l'detzivi, the rabbanan praised the person who would provide fuel. The Rav Chista kol aklide hava master l'shame bar m'detzivi, because Rav Chista would give to his shamas, his worker, his servant, all his storehouses except for the one containing the wood. Because it's far more necessary. You need the wood, a quantity of wood far greater in order to provide the equivalent supply of the other staples. Okay, so this is everyone's getting ready for the siege. Everyone's all excited. There was enough supplies to provide for all of Yerushalayim for 21 years. They could have lasted out that siege for 21 years, says the Gemara. But, Havabuhu Hanhu Biryoni, there was within Yerushalayim brigands, Biryonim. Now there's going to be a little bit of discussion, some little bit of politics over here. Amalhu Rabbanon, the rabbi said, let's go and make peace with the Romans. Lo shavkinu. The brigands, the Brionim, would not allow such a thing. It's interesting to know just exactly who were the peacemakers as the Gemara describes it. Who was leading the peace movement of the day? The Rabbanan, the rabbis. So, Amar Luhu. So the Biryonim said, Nepok Benavid Krava Bahadaihu, let's go out and we'll fight those Romans. Let's fight for our independence and defend ourselves. Why should we capitulate to the great power of the world? Why should we allow the Romans to take taxes from us? We should defend ourselves against the Romans and fight them. Amar Luhu L'Rabbanan, Lo Mispayeh Milsa. That's very good in principle. It's just not going to work. You're not going to win against the Roman army. Kamu kalnahu lahanhu ambare dechiti visare vahava kafna. The Brionim got up and they burned down all the supply sheds of food. And sure enough, there was a famine. And that's where the Talmud continues describing the extent of the famine as that piece of Talmud continues. So here we have a description of Sinat Chinam of a different type. This isn't the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, of a specific insult, but rather a problem of how politics is conducted. We have two groups here, as the Gemara describes it. We have the Rabbanan, the rabbis, and we have the Brionim, and we have the brigands. And they're both coexisting within this city. They're both there together. And they start off having a discussion. This person takes this position, this person takes this position, and they're at a stalemate. They recognize that they're going to have to do it together. And when that stalemate is reached, how is it resolved? With violence. By burning down the storehouses. And that's how the famine begins. And that's how the Romans were able to successfully conquer Yerushalayim. Unless you think this is only a Gemara, which has those rabbis with their muster trying to tell people what they've done wrong and trying to get people to be better. It's not just the rabbis. A man by the name of Josephus Flavius, Josephus as we know him, wrote a history of the events of this time period. He himself was a party to those events. He was a leader in the Galil of some of the battalion of Jewish soldiers who fought the Romans. He was captured by the Romans, and eventually he went over to the Roman side and was an aide de camp to Vespasian and to Titus, and was the writer of the official history of this great conquest. So anything we read about from Josephus, number one, we have to be cautious because he's writing under the thumb of the Romans. He wants the Romans to look good to some degree when he writes this history. But then again, he's still a Jew. And he's going to tell you how he feels from as a prisoner of the Romans and give us in some ways an insight into this time period. So this is taken from the Jewish War. It's book 4. Chapter 3 and subsection 2. The citizens, source number 3, were in a state of confusion, but the country's population had been torn by dissension even before sedition had reared its head in Jerusalem. Let's flip this page over. 4, and now we're going to read left to right. For when Titus had left Gishala for Caesarea, Vespasian had proceeded from Caesarea to Yamnina and Azotus, and reduced and garrisoned these towns, returning with a large mass of prisoners who had surrendered on terms. So these are the two Roman generals. Vespasian was the father, Titus was his son, and they are together leading the campaign of the Romans against Judea, against the Jewish people. Every town... The bold here is my own. It's so the people who are sleeping a little bit, they want to know what's really important, they can look at the bold text. Every town was seething with turmoil and civil war. And the moment that they had respite from the Romans, they turned against each other. Contention raged fiercely between the advocates of war and the lovers of peace. First of all, in the homes, this party rivalry disrupted unity among those who had long been bosom friends. Then, the nearest relatives severed all former ties, and attaching themselves to men who shared their respective views, lined up on opposite sides. Factionalism reigned everywhere. The revolutionary and military party, with the boldness of youth, silenced the old and prudent. Who are the two parties here, according to Josephus? How are the lines being drawn? We have the revolutionary and militant party, the group that wants to fight the Romans, to remove their influence, who are represented by the youth, and who on the other side, who are they silencing? The old and the prudent, who, if we again review back at the Gemara in Gittin that we just read, we might substitute the words Rabbanan for. The various cliques began by plundering their neighbors. Then they banded themselves into companies and extended their depredations all over the countryside. So much so that in lawlessness and brutality, the Romans were no worse than the victims' own countrymen. When he says this, I just, number one, you cry. Number two, you wonder a little bit whether Josephus isn't just being nice to the Romans. In fact, to be captured by the Romans seemed to the unfortunate victims far preferable. In every bit of propaganda, there always is going to be some bit of truth. And Josephus, while he is writing as under the thumb of the Romans, he's describing a reality of a sort, that we were worse to one another than the Romans were to us. Number three, over here on in the source. The garrisons of the towns, partly to avoid taking risks and partly from their hatred of the people, did little or nothing to protect the distressed. This is a reference to the Romans. The Romans did nothing to stop this infighting. In the end, the brigand chiefs, having their fill of pillaging the country, joined forces and formed a single pack of villainy. All the brigand chiefs came together from all over the land, all over Judea, all over the land of Israel, and they formed a single pack. They all crept into Yerushalayim, to Jerusalem, a city without military commanders, and one which, according to hereditary custom, anyone of Jewish blood was admitted without scrutiny. There were no metal detectors going into Yerushalayim. There was no basis by which you could exclude someone from coming to Yerushalayim. Everyone was welcome in Jerusalem. A city, moreover, where at the moment everyone thought that those who were erupting came out of goodwill as allies. Yet it was this very feature, the very feature of Chesed, the very fact that Yerushalayim is a place where everyone is welcome, the very fact that Yerushalayim is a place where everyone can come to be Ola Regel, ultimately ruined the city. It was ultimately the cause of Yerushalayim's fall. For supplies, and remember the Gemara, for supplies which might have been adequate for the combatants were squandered upon a useless and idle mob who, in addition to war, brought on themselves faction and starvation. What was the cause of Yerushalayim's fall according to Josephus? It was this infighting and was these brigands who came into Yerushalayim and created war within our own ranks. Other brigands from the country who slipped into the city and joined the even more formidable gang within refrained from no enormity henceforth. They did not limit their audacity to raids and brigandage, but proceeded to commit murders, not by night, or secretly, or against the common people, but openly, by day, beginning with the most eminent citizens. The first victim whom they seized was Antipas, a member of the royal family, and one of the most influential men in the city, who was entrusted also with the public treasury. They seized and imprisoned him. Next came Levius, one of the most eminent men in the city, and Sisyphus, son of Aregetus, both of royal blood, besides other prominent men throughout the country. Terror filled the people, and as if the enemy had taken the city by storm, no one thought of anything but his own security. We read through these words from Josephus, and we understand the phrase of Sinat Chinam in a more, graphic way than just the Gemara would have described it. But I think also we can begin to appreciate the challenge of repairing this sin. The Gemara in Yuma, the first source, continues to describe and ask the question, which was worse, the first temple or the second temple's sins? which one was a more problematic lifestyle, a more problematic time period for our people. And the Gemara in Yuma says, look around. Look at Yerushalayim. The first temple sins was quickly rebuilt. After that time, after those sins, they could look and see the temple. The temple's back there again. The second temple was never rebuilt. And therefore, argues the Gemara, it's obvious which was worse. Even though the Jews of the Second Temple period studied Torah, performed mitzvos, acted towards this value of doing kindness to one another, gemilas chesed, still that period was worse because of this sinat chinam. The Gemara in Yuma goes on to describe Rishonim Shniskala Avonam Niskala Kitzam. The first temple, the first Jews, whose sin was revealed and clear to them, their end, or the end of their exile, was revealed. Achronim Shelo Niskala Avonam. The later peoples, whose sin was not obvious to them, Lo Niskala Kitzam. Their end of their exile was never revealed, and is still not revealed to this day. That within the sin of sinat chinam is a deeper problem from other sins, which is that even at the end of the whole story, after the destruction of Yerushalayim, each side says, you know what? It's their fault. It's the fault of the other side. That's why this happened. That's why there was this problem. And so as a result, there's no way to repair it. There's no way to confront the problem if you're unaware of what that problem is. If it's always the other guy's fault, it's the other party's issue, it's you never have to look inward, you never have to change. So what are we to learn? What is there to gain from this lesson? Mipnei Shehayta Bo Sinat Chinam. Where is the source for inspiration for how we're able to one day recover from that sin? The crucial step in reading through the story of Josephus and in reading through these Gemaras is to recognize that we the people who come to a shul on a Tisha B'Av, we are still those people who are osek the Torah of mitzvot and milas chasadim. That's who we are. We're people who value Torah, people who value mitzvot, people who perform chesed. But even we are still subject to that same problem, the same possibility of sinat chinam. When you read a Gemara like this, it has to speak to us as individuals and as a community, that the threat of infighting, the threat of this hate, is something that becomes very, very real to us in our day as well. We have Jewish politics today, here in North America, here in Canada, we have politics in Israel. I would urge each of us, after appreciating the real politics, the sense of echa, of not just the why, but also the how, to appreciate how in our political discourse, and how we discuss with friends, and how we engage in community activities, and how we speak about what goes on in Israel, that we remain carefully aware of how we debate. We should be osek b'Torah. We should perform mitzvot. We should be gomel chesed. But we must be always cautious in how we disagree. May we merit to see the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, as we are able to properly respond to the problems of sinat chinam, with avat chinam, with the unjustified love to repair the unjustified hates.